Well, I guess after that warm welcome, my introduction is actually superfluous, really. But nevertheless, it's good to see so many of you here. And can I make a special mention that we're delighted that the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, is here with us as well. So we're very pleased. And someone is pointing. Yes, Sadiq Khan is here. I think he deserves a round of applause. The ever-popular Sadiq Khan, I should have said. We're delighted also that we have the current director, Dame Manoush Shafiq, the previous director, Tony Giddens, many distinguished guests, alumni, students, you're all very welcome as well. In actual fact, as you can see, it's a packed theatre. We could, let me say, have filled this theatre three times over. So if you didn't actually sell your ticket on eBay, you missed an opportunity, okay? I should also say that the lecture is being live-streamed, so I should welcome those watching through their own computers. And the lecture will subsequently be available to download as a podcast. As you can see, we have a lot of press interest, surprisingly. TV, cameras around the place, etc. And of course, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to join me to give a warm welcome to our speaker. Although, I must say, I suspect that when some of our Eurosceptic press reported in the morning, I suspect it's going to be reported as modest applause. So we take that into account as well. Now, tonight's lecture is part of our public lecture program, and I think the public lecture program at the LSE is one of those very special things about being a member of the school. I think for students, it's part of that extra dimension of studying here. It's something which gives that extra dimension to the community life of the school. But it is also a lecture which is hosted by the Institute for Public Affairs and by the European Institute, and it's part of our series of the LSE programme on Brexit. So in a few weeks' time, for example, we'll be pleased to be hosting the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. And we expect other events during the academic year as well. But of course, tonight we're talking about the future of Europe post-Brexit. And our speaker, of course, is very well placed to be talking on this topic. He has, for example, written a number of books which have been translated into many languages, including English. And the titles of the books indicate his political vision. The United States of Europe. For Europe, most recently, Europe's Last Chance, Why European States Should Form a More Perfect Union. So you can appreciate his standpoint. But of course, Guy Verhofstadt has also had a political career which has placed him very much at the center of European affairs. Minister and then Prime Minister in Belgium, President of the European Council on one occasion, member of the European Parliament since 2009, leader of the Liberal Alliance in the European Parliament. You might think, therefore, that Guy Verhofstadt politically has done it all. Well, not quite. In 2004, it was suggested that Guy Verhofstadt might become President of the European Commission. It was immediately then reported that the British Prime Minister at the time, Tony Blair, blocked the nomination for fear that Guy Verhofstadt would be too pro-European or too federalist for British sensibilities. Guy Verhofstadt... his subsequent laments, quote, "If it hadn't been for Tony Blair, will, I think, be a lament that many at the LSE would appreciate with a wider resonance, a wider connotation across many different fields. But we're delighted that he's able to join us. Of course, at the moment, he is the European Parliament's lead on Brexit, and the European Parliament will have to confirm any Brexit deal. So I suspect that's why we're going to be listening to his words particularly carefully here in London. Guy has agreed to speak for about 30 minutes. That should give us plenty of time for questions and answers subsequently. Let me then simply ask that you put your mobile phones to mute. You can, if you wish, follow us on Twitter. There is a hashtag on the screen. You can follow us on social media. But let's begin. So can you please join me in giving a very warm LSE welcome to our speaker this evening, Guy Verhofstadt.
Thank you. Well, there is more applause here than in the European Parliament, I can tell you. So, but it was not very nice to all these bad memories that you have brought up. But it's true, it's typical European. It's like when it should be a little bit of following comparison that in the Catholic Church, when they nominate a pope, that they say not too Catholic, not too that is not that. But ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, and I will also I thank very much the Mayor of London for his presence this evening. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. It's not my first time that I am in this fantastic audience. I think the third time already. But I have to tell you, it is a little bit surrealistic that I am giving a speech about the future of Europe here in London, the capital of a country that is about to leave the Union, while then Prime Minister May gave her speech on Brexit in a European city, in Florence. And I can tell you, citizens of Florence, the last thing what they're going to do is to leave the Union. So, but I know why I'm here in London. And it is because my good friend Paul de Grauwe, who is professor here in economics at the university, invited me. And I can't say no to Paul, who also we share a little bit of a political career. I don't know if it is the best memory of his career, but I think I have to tell you that I also know why Theresa May gave her speech in Florence. I presume that I know it. I think she chose Florence because Florentine politics in the 15th century made her feel at home, I think. You know, backstabbing. You know, backstabbing, betrayal, noble families fighting for power, and so on and so on. So I think that it is an environment that she recognized very well. But let me come back. This was a joke, so because I say it for the press, because tomorrow in the Sun and so on, I see already the titles of the articles. But let me come back to the content of the Prime Minister's speech. Mrs. May said in Florence that, and I quote her, throughout its membership, the United Kingdom has never totally felt at home being in the European Union. That was literally what she said in her speech. I have to tell you, that could have been a quote of Paul de Grauwe. Because also, my friend Paul believes that, Britain was never a member with its whole heart, and always one foot in, one foot out, sometimes blocking, always complaining. But for once, I have to tell you, I don't agree with his reasoning. While this is true, I think, for most British politicians and also for most English newspapers, I think this is not the case for what seems to be today, again, a majority of British citizens. It's true, it's a majority now. It was only 48% of people voted Remain during the referendum. But I think that even 48% is not a minority you can ignore. Because doing politics, in my point of view, is trying to take all big opinions on board and to find compromises, not to poke up differences. I think it was John Stuart Mill teaches us that democracy, ladies and gentlemen, is not a dictatorship of the majority, and certainly not on fundamental issues, on issues of vital interest, national interest. And I think membership of the Union is, I think, a vital national issue and interest. And that on these issues, the view and the wishes of in fact, every significant group of citizens need to be taken on board. And I see this, I can tell you, in the thousands of letters and mails I receive, I read how attached still so many British citizens, hundreds of thousands, I think even millions of them, they are still cherish their European identity and they want to keep their European citizenship. But I agree with at least one sentence in the speech of Mrs. May. At the very beginning, she referred to the Renaissance as a period of history that defined what it meant to be European. Well, that's exactly what the European Union is all about. The European Union, ladies and gentlemen, is far more than a peace process after the Second World War, far more than the Franco-German reconciliation alone. The European Union is all about civilization. It's in fact the political translation of that civilization, of that European common culture and values. That is what is the European Union about. And more important than our common past, I think, and that is in the heart of the European project, we have a common political language. Our philosophic references are all the same. We read the same books. Our reference point are John Locke, our reference point are Montesquieu, Immanuel Kant. David Hume was not only a Scottish philosopher, not only a British philosopher, above all, he was the father of skepticism, not of Euroscepticism, of skepticism. And who shaped, in fact, the thinking of so many generations of Europeans. And in fact, it's the same is true for other areas like literature, for theater, for architecture. If you travel, for example, from the Irish Sea all over the continent, all the way to the Volga, so much further than the European Union of today, well, you will find the same buildings, the same styles, Art Nouveau, Art Deco, modernism. And this common culture is nothing highbrow, not just for the elite, it has impregnated our thinking. Let me give you one example. When we were all impatient for Britain to trigger Article 50 after the referendum, I didn't use the saying, waiting for Godot, not once, but several hundreds of times. And the famous theatre piece of Samuel Beckett has become, yes, a European concept. So the reality of the European civilization is also the reason I have to tell you why I'm fighting for European citizenship as a translation towards the citizens. What does it mean to belong to Europe and European civilization? And for me, being a European citizen, is not the byproduct of your nationality, because you are by accident born in one of our 28 member states. For me, European citizenship is the expression that we belong to the same European community, to the same European society. And you know that British citizens will lose their European citizenship, and that for many of them, this will happen against their will. And I think that the fact that hundreds of thousands, I think even millions, want to keep their European citizenship is the proof, first of all, we have to take that in account, and secondly, is the proof that the European project is about much more than the single market, much more than the common currency. All very good things, eh? Don't get me wrong, but that's not the essence, in fact, of our European project. The essence is, in fact, the understanding inside Europe that identities are not simple, are not straightforward. Then you cannot do politics in categorizing identities, that they are multi-layered, that they are complex, and moreover, that there are, in fact, as many identities as there are people in the world. So criticizing people for wanting to keep that European identity, accusing them of split allegiance, is binary, is old-fashioned. I think it's reductionist view on identity. I think it's perfect possible, but I look to the mayor who has more experience to be a Londoner, English, British, and European at the same time. There is no contradiction. And it has nothing to do with split allegiance. So my message in the beginning of my intervention, watch out, beware of politicians who want to define your identity. The only reason they do so is to categorize people, to reduce you to your nationality, your ethnicity, your religion, and split allegiance are two words that belong to the language of states that are, in my opinion, totalitarian and not of democracies, like Britain. In all democracies, people define their own allegiance, define themselves how British and how European they feel, and not the Minister of Foreign Affairs, if I may say so. But let me come back to the talk of today, Brexit. I have to tell you very honestly, and I said it already a few times, but I want to repeat it here in London, that I continue to believe that Brexit is a very negative project, that it is in fact a waste of time and energy. The destruction of a strong political bond that made people on both sides of the channel richer, freer than ever before. But we are Democrats. We have to respect the outcome of that referendum. And moreover, we have to implement it, and that is exactly what Europe will do. And also will establish a new relationship between the European Union and the UK that hopefully will be beneficial for everybody, for both. And if you ask me the question, yeah, is there really, really, really nothing positive you can say about Brexit? Well, I'm going to say yes, there is something positive. It has opened people's eyes on the continent. It would have given, if I would have given Professor Hiv the same speech 1 year ago, it would have been a depressive one. And you would go out all depressive. Since Brexit, I see that the mood has reversed. That in fact, yeah, in a certain way, the European Union regained popularity. Note that people are less critical now towards the Union, I should say, on the contrary, but they want to reform Europe, not to leave Europe, not to destroy it. You know, everybody expected, let's be honest, after the Brexit, a type of a domino effect. And everybody talked about the Frexit and the Dexit and the Nexit and a number of other exits. And what happened was quite, the opposite. What happened was that in Austria, people voted for Van der Bellen, who was the pro-European candidate in a third round. I never well understand why there was this third round in Austrian elections. But they voted for Van der Bellen, and 300,000 votes went from the candidate who wanted to take Austria out of the Euro, out of the European Union, towards the pro-European candidate. And that happened a few months after Brexit. And in the Netherlands, a little bit later, it were the pro-European parties who won the election. It was not Geert Wilders, who got 13%, 1-3, and who wanted to lead Holland out of the Euro and out of the European Union. It were the pro-European parties who won the most seats there. Also a number of months after Brexit. And in France, we have all followed it, 2/3 of the French citizens voted for Emmanuel Macron and for his pro-European project. The same Emmanuel Macron, now president of the French Republic, as you know and as you have heard, gave 2 days ago a speech at the Sorbonne university in Paris, a university almost as good as LSA, we can say. It's true, it's older, 12th century, 19th century, there's quite a difference of age. Well, I think he has given an impressive account, on which direction Europe should go. He spoke about the reform of the Eurozone, the establishment of a European Defence Union, the introduction of a European Border and Coast Guard, a European Department of Justice, a European Minimum Wage, a real European Energy Union. But he spoke also about other things, like the need for multilingual education in Europe. And it was a long list of real European constructive proposals that lasted, I think, 1.5 hours, even longer than Jeremy Corbyn at his party conference last week, and that says all as we know. So today, I want to highlight, in fact, from that, two specific proposals that show what has changed since Brexit on the issue of the future of the European Union. That there has been a fundamental shift in the thinking about Europe in the heads of a number of people and leaders in Europe. And that is not to look anymore to Europe and the European Union as a bunch of nation states, but as a genuine political community, as a democracy on continental scale. And two proposals that I already defended that a number of years ago, but nobody believed to be realistic, toward dreams and that would never realize themselves, are proof of that. The first proposal is the call, you have seen that, I hope, for transnational lists. The idea to turn the European Union in one big constituency and to give to all citizens in Europe two ballots. One to choose their own representative of their country in the parliament, and a second one to elect a number of politicians on the European level, what in my opinion will make European politics more democratic and what will lift, in fact, this European democracy on a continental scale, what we absolutely need. And the second proposal, also that shows that we go into a direction where we see the European democracy as something new and not a bunch of nation states, but a real political community, is his proposal to reshape the European Commission into a new, small, effective European government of only 12 to 15 ministers. And he said, if that means that France doesn't have a commissioner, so be it. I can tell you that's a revolution in itself if it is said by a French president. No, really. He said also that European sovereignty is more important, that was when he was still candidate, than national sovereignty. Normally you're already disqualified in France if you say something like that. Not this time. Not this time. But don't misunderstand me. We will need naturally much more than these two changes. Transnational list to build up European democracy on the continental scale. Another way of dealing and governing the European, a small government instead of a European Commission in which every member state automatically have to be represented. It will meet far more changes than this. What the European Union really needs is naturally a big overhaul. Because at the root cause of all our problems, of our so-called, I call it a polycrisis, because at the same time you have still the aftermath of the financial crisis, you have the problems with the migration flows, you have the geopolitical weakness of our continent. There is Brexit, because that's a failure, let's be honest. It's when an important country like Britain breaks away, it's a failure. So I think that the root cause of all these problems, of the so-called polycrisis, is political. Is institutional. The problem in Europe is its wrong political architecture and the fact that we have not fully implemented the basic ideas of our founding fathers that they proposed in the aftermath of the Second World War in the 50s. The problem, in fact, let me tell you it very bluntly, the Union is in fact not a union. It's a loose confederation of nation states today. And all based on the unanimity rule. And on top of that, Yeah, we don't have, in fact, one European Union. We have at least a dozen of European Unions. The European Union of Schengen, European Union of the European Patent, European Union of the Prüm Convention, of the Euro, of EFTA, of Europol, of the Fiscal Compact, of the Stability Mechanism. And every time, every country, like going into a restaurant, can pick and choose on the menu what they want and what they don't want. And it makes it even more complicated because from time to time there are some members, countries outside the European Union who participate in European politics, why it is not necessary that all member states participate in the same European politics. You have to know, I'm always giving the following comparison to make it clear what the problem is. Imagine one moment, 5 minutes, the following thing, that is that the United States of America should be governed like the European Union today. How should it work? First of all, we should not have one Obama or one Trump, but three Obamas and worse, three Trumps. That should be the case. So, because there is no one real leadership in the Union. And secondly, most important, America will be governed by the 50 governors of the 50 states, who gathering together from time to time, 5 times a year, in Washington, all 50, to decide on every policy of the United States. Syria, what we do. Korea, what we do. Climate change, what is our policy? Coming together, and one governor has the possibility, even of the smaller state, to block the whole decision and the whole process. What currently happens in the Union? And what's more, if the United States was governed like the European Union, well, yeah, states could opt out on crucial policy domains. For example, California saying, well, this dollar is a fine currency, but we like more the old Spanish peseta that we used until the mid of the 19th century, because that was the case in California. Or, for example, Florida saying, well, the American Border and Coast Guard, not for me, I'm going to do it myself. Or, for example, another state, whatever, the Texas, for example, saying, well, the FBI, nice organization, but I'm going to take an opt-out on this. I don't participate in this. That's not, I'm going to do it myself. And everybody, we all, should say these Americans are nuts. Well, that's exactly, and we should say that can never work. Well, that's exactly how Europe works today, or better, from time to time, doesn't work today. And there is the problem. And that's also the reason, Paul, I think that you will agree with me, why, to give another example, in the field of economics, so I'm a lawyer, so that's now very dangerous to do that before an economic professor, why America emerges so much earlier from the crisis than we did. Even though the crisis started there, in the US, America with his political institutions launched, in fact, in 9 months, not more than that, an impressive 3-stage rocket to deal with that financial crisis. Immediately launched TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, $400 billion to clean up the banks and the insurance companies in the US. Then followed by a second stage, the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that is $900 billion investment program covering 2009, 2019, it's still in place. And then three, the support by the Federal Reserve Board, quantitative easing, immediately from the beginning for a staggering amount of $1.3 trillion. We did it also, quantitative easing, yeah, to avoid deflation at the end, not in the beginning, to stimulate the economy. So that is what in the US happens. There is institutions, whatever the majority is. The Democrats were in place, the Republicans were in place. Then came the Obama administration. The Democrats took it over. They did it, 9 months. And in the meanwhile, we saw in Europe exactly the opposite. We have still not fully overcome the fallout of the financial crisis of 2008. And we are still debating the right strategy. Is it growth or is it austerity? Is it Krugman or is it Ferguson? Or maybe, Paul, I can say, is it Paul de Grauwe? Or Olly Rehn, so to make a comparison. And the problem is not that there are people like Krugman or Ferguson or Rehn or de Grauwe. The problem is that in an intergovernmental system, as we have today, if half of the political leaders in Europe, half of the political leaders are saying that that is the solution for the problem, and half of the political leaders in the Council think that it is the other way around, nothing is happening. There is a standstill for years. In a communitarian system, I call it a federal system, I know that is the word not to use, and I'm always saying, what is the problem? The most seen as the most powerful nation worldwide is a federal state, no? US? And today seen as the most effective European state in Europe is a federal state, is Germany. So what is the problem? They say, yeah, we have to do like that. They have good results. But when it concerns then to apply the institutional setup, then we have problems. But in a communitarian system, the majority shows the way. That is the difference with an intergovernmental system that blocks. And even when it's a way I don't like, it's in any way better than no way at all. And it is our intergovernmental system, our unanimity rule, that makes that 10 years after the outbreak of the crisis, all European banks, for the to give only one example, are still weak, are still not cleaned up, and also that the Eurozone is still not reformed and needs to be reformed. And it's even clearer when I talk about another area, and that's my next example, that is our defense policy. It was Jean-Claude Juncker who said in the State of the Union a few weeks ago that by 2025, we need a full-fledged European defense union. We need it, and NATO wants it. That was what he said. I said, finally, because why? Well, why combined the 28 European armies in Europe spend more or less 40-45% of the American defense budget? And some people can say, yeah, that is less. Yeah, true, but it's not bad given that America is a big spender on military budget. And it's still three times much as Russia, for example. It's the second biggest budget worldwide. And the reality, that's the input, because now I'm going to talk with you about the output, we can only do 10, some people are saying, 12% of America's military operations, certainly not more than what the Russian army is capable of doing. And I'm only a lawyer, I have to tell you, by training. But even I can have a sense of basic maths. I was also Minister of Budget, and then you need that a little bit, naturally. Even when I'm always saying, the only thing what the Minister of Budget has to know is the word no. All the rest is not necessary when you do it. But a little bit of basic maths are useful. Well, the reality, if you put 40, 42, 45% of money and you can only do 10 or 12% of the operations for the American army, that means that you are four times less efficient. That is the reality. And that is normal because the 28 member states do 28 times the same thing. And it's true, we have an inflation of bilateral regional cooperation. The Benelux, Scandinavia, the Baltics, the Franco-German Brigade, the Belgian-Dutch Navy, the Italian-French cooperation. But all these bilateral cooperations are merely, in fact, papering the cracks. What we really need is a European Defence Union. Call it European Army, call it what you want, but that is the way forward. And these are only two examples that show that, in parallel, I think, with Brexit, we need, and we will start now, a deep reform of the Union. And there is not a lack of preparation, I can tell you. There are already three papers, reports on the future of the Union, of the European Union, that have been adopted by the European Parliament. There are seven reflection papers that have been adopted by the European Commission on different elements of the future of the European Union. Moreover, there are two interinstitutional reports. So interinstitutional, that means the three institutions together, Council, Commission, and Parliament, on the financing of the Union, and also on the governance of the Eurozone. So it's not that we don't know what to do. And on top of that now, I expect also that with Macron launching its vision, also other political leaders will come out. In any way, in my point of view, what is necessary are the following building blocks. First of all, when we talk about Schengen, European border and Coast Guard, to manage free movement, to make also a crucial step in a real European migration and asylum policy. And there is a lot of things to do, because we have no European asylum policy. Dublin is the negation, I should say, of a common European system, putting the burden automatically on two countries in reality. And also with the necessary, the necessary instruments. Today we spent on border defense on the European level the amount of 240 million euro. Inside Homeland Security, that's the American counterpart for border management, it's $30 billion. You can compare. Secondly, European investigation and intelligence capacity, call it European FBI or whatever. And why? Because every time when there is a terrorist attack, we see that different national intelligence and security agency had different pieces of the puzzle, but no one has really the oversight. FBI was created in the US in 1900 after the murder of McKinley, an American president, in a terrorist attack. And they said it cannot go further like that. We need to, for crimes that are interstate, to build something up. And that became the FBI, who is now responsible for 200 type of crimes. The same what happened, in fact, in Germany. The Bundeskriminalamt was only a loose coordination organ between, in fact, the lender who were responsible for policy. Today, and after what happened in München in the Olympic Games, it is upgraded to Bundeskriminalamt, who has autonomy to investigate, to gather intelligence, and so on and so on. Well, I think the same needs to happen on the European level. Terrorists don't know any border. It are our police forces who still know borders in the exchange of their information. There is the European Defence Union. I will not repeat what I said. I explained it a few moments ago. That is crucial, certainly in a time where an American president is saying that we need to take more our responsibility. And he's right in that respect. And I don't think that it is mainly by increasing the budget, but by doing what is needed, that is to create one community so that we can, in fact, have far better results with the same money that we spend today. We need a government for the euro, one with one minister of finance, with a budget, a fiscal capacity. That is, that also what the French president has said, has to be a multiple of the current budget, a budget that is financed, in my opinion, with own resources, instead of contributions for the member states, so that there is a direct link, so as in every democracy, between what the people are paying and the policies that are developed, and there is a control of them. There is, everybody says, no taxation without representation, but representation without taxation, that's the world on his head. So we need to rethink also the whole euro governance, because the system of today, in my opinion, doesn't work very well. A stability and growth pact, in other words, budgetary rules that are in fact not always, not to say never applies, while the new euro governance should in fact in other system with member states who receive incentives to reform their labor market, their pension systems, their economies. And I have to tell you that on that specific issue, and I take this opportunity to underline this, the last days there is a lot to do about the outcome of the German election on this issue, and the result of the FDP, the Liberal Party in Germany. It's true that they are very strict when it comes to the euro, that they want that the rules to be applied. But I wonder too, why you have rules if you don't apply them? And the point is that I see no contradiction, in fact, between those who want to apply the rules, what is in fact not really happening today, and those who want a new governance for the eurozone. It's exactly that new euro governance that has to ensure that rules are applied, that reforms are made, and continue looking like today and putting our head in the sand is certainly not the way forward. And again, on top of that, and I want to do that here in London, the FDP is a party which is strongly anchored in the legacy of Hans-Dietrich Genscher, is in favour for a European defence union, in favour of European investigation and security capabilities, in favour of transnationalists, and in favour of a decentralised federal Europe. So the point is a little bit different than has been described the last days. But talking about the FDP brings me, in fact, to the ultimate question that we have to raise this evening. Is it possible to deeply reform the European Union? Because that is what you hear. Yeah, those are fantastic ideas, but that is what we need. But yeah, it's not going to happen. Well, I say yes. And the reason why I'm confident and optimistic about this is the fact that we did it already before. It's not the first crisis of Europe. In the past, in the 80s, you remember that maybe, that had another name. It was not Euroscepticism, it was Eurosclerosis was the name at that moment that was used. That was the time that the European economy suffered from stagflation, the combination of, stagnation and inflation. Low growth, high unemployment, rising debts. In the 80s, you remember, fueled by this increase of the prices of energy. And in that period, people were also very unhappy with the European project. And at that time, as I said, it was called Eurosclerosis. It lasted 4 years until there was a leader in Europe, that was Jacques Delors, who decided to do something about it and to launch something, not to pandering on the negative feelings, but by reforming the Union and by launching a positive project. And that was the idea of 1992. The launch of the internal market with billboards and so on, where he got rid of customs duties that companies had to pay to transport their goods from one country to the other, where he got rid of border controls for people also, and no more long waiting lines when you went to another country. And he made it also possible for service providers to obtain one single license that allowed them then to do business everywhere in the European Union. That was the idea in the 80s, start 1992. And what happened, it was an enormous success. What happened was also that our small and medium companies everywhere in Europe started already before 92 to prepare themselves. It created 3% average of growth in that period. And Jacques Delors didn't say, oh, people are unhappy with the Union, so we should give up on it. No, he said, people are unhappy with the Union, so we should reform it. Make it work again. And Delors had this offensive strategy, which was still in the heart of the European project, this internal market. And in my opinion, that's also the strategy to follow today. A project, a vision that people can follow. The task of politicians is not to follow always what people say, no, to create a vision and to try to convince the people of that vision and of that prospect. And as I'm in London here, I want to remind that Jacques Delors didn't do this alone. The mastermind behind the internal market was a Brit, Lord Cofield. He was the driving force behind that formidable project. And I want to quote Margaret Thatcher on that project, because normally she was not very lyric, but on that issue, yes. A single market, I quote, without barriers, visible or invisible, giving you direct and unhindered access to the purchasing power of over 300 million of world's wealthiest and most prosperous people, bigger than Japan, bigger than the United States, on your doorstep and with the Channel Tunnel to give you direct access to it. That was her defense of the European Union and of the internal market at that time. And I think even whatever will happen with Brexit, the European Union has the duty to build further on this legacy. Further on this legacy, and that means completing the internal market, completing it with what we have not now, energy market, a capital market, a digital market, with single European supervisors and not 27 different national ones. Because if we look to digital companies and to new tech companies, they are all American. or Asian, how is that possible? And we have the biggest market. Because if a young company has a new application and want to launch it in Europe, he needs 27, in fact, authorization to do so. And he needs to make a deal with more than 120 mobile operators before he can launch it. In the US, it's very simple. In other countries, your one authorization, FCA is it called in the US, and you make a deal with three big mobile operators and you launch it. That's one of the reasons, for example, that Spotify, many people think it's an American company. In fact, it's a Swedish company who went to America because it was not possible to roll it out in the same conditions as in this other big market. So that we need to realize. And also with new, in my opinion, competition rules. New competition rules that no longer look at regional dominance. Typical for our competition rules, we're saying against a merger of two companies, no, that cannot happen. Why? They're going to have a dominant position on the North Scandinavian market. What the hell of the North Scandinavian market? We are the European market. We need European champions who can become world companies. So that is not what is happening now. That is that on certainly digital and on high tech, they are all American, all Asian, and not one European. And then finally also, and I think that London will recognize that, speeding up free trade. Speeding up free trade arrangements. Certainly now that there is a doubt from the American side and that protectionism is coming back, we need with the four corners of the world to trade. Japan, we are busy. India, we're going to launch. Brazil, New Zealand, Australia. And not wait for that. The world of tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, and that is my message of this evening, is a world of empires, not longer a world of nation states. And let's hope that it are empires of the good and not empires of the bad, as we have seen in the past. And Europe, only a united Europe will be capable to play a role of significance, to put their standards on the table, to fight for their and your citizens' interest. And to make that happen, we need only one thing, in fact, because everything is in place. And Macron, in a certain way, has already shown the way. And to express what we need, I will use the words of a French revolutionary, Danton. And he said, first in French, "De l'audace, encore de l'audace, toujours de l'audace." Audacity, more audacity, forever audacity. That is what we need. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for that modest applause. We don't have so much time, and I know that there are going to be many questions. I wonder if I could start off with one...
More than 30 minutes. Yeah, that's a...
It was worth it. Otherwise, I'd have come across to the microphone. There's one issue, of course, which you didn't touch on and would be of particular concern to the LSE community. Almost 40% of LSE faculty are EU non-UK origin. A similar percentage of our students is recruited from the rest of the European Union. As the Brexit negotiations proceed, one issue of great sensitivity is the protection of EU citizens within the UK. Now, I appreciate that you will say that the European Court of Justice must have authority in this area. And the British Prime Minister has, of course, said that this is a red line. Can you see the outlines of any deal which would give reassurance to EU citizens in the UK?
Well, first of all, it's impossible to predict what the outcome of a negotiation will be. But what I know is what the European Parliament has put on the table and what for the Parliament, who has to give the green light at the end, will be absolutely key. And that is that we want for the EU citizens, and also I want to tell that the UK citizens living on the continent, we don't make a difference between EU citizens living here and UK citizens living on the continent. There has to be symmetry. And there's no reason why I say, the EU citizens that interest us. What, UK citizens not long? No, we are a parliament. A parliament is made to defend the interests of the citizens. And I think whatever nationality they have living on your territory. So the main thing, what we are looking for, is a collective solution in which we simply keep the rights as they are. There are more than 3 million of these EU citizens living in Britain, a little bit more than one of UK citizens living on the continent. What we want is simply the continuation of the existing situation with the same rights, the same oversight, and so we have not to invent anything. And that is the main difference of point of view with the proposal of the UK government, who has done a proposal of a settled status, so a new concept in the UK immigration law, where it will be necessary that these 3 million people all fill in a request, not one by family. Yeah? If you are 3 family members, 3 requests. 5 family members, 4 children, 5 family requests. In which then the authorities, you need then to prove a number of things before you can have this settled status. And on top of that, it's not covering all the rights that are covered today. So there is a huge difference on family reunification, who will be made very difficult, if not even impossible, under that settled status, while we are saying, well, we have to invent nothing at all. It's in place. Let's recognize for the 3 million, let's recognize for the more than 1 million UK, and we keep it as it is.
Okay. So when you go to number 10, before you go back to Belgium, you'll be saying...
I'm invited there? I don't know. No.
You'll be saying to Theresa May, no compromise from the European Parliament position.
There's no give on that issue. On that issue, she had made an opening in the speech she did in Florence, the direct influence of that... of these rights in UK law. So there is a certain opening that has been made, but it's not covering all the rights as we see it. And the main problem is, in my eyes, the problem that it is not a collective solution, but an individual that will create an enormous administrative burden of millions of files with proofs. And on top of that, the reason why I'm also critical towards the system that has been put on the table by the UK government is the fact that we see already today practices of Home Office and from other departments where people who are completely allowed to have some permits have already difficulties, yes, or receive a letter of deportation of whatever. So that's the reason why in the name of the Brexit Steering Group I wrote a letter to Amber Rudd to say, yeah, you know that this and this and this and this is happening today? That said, also on the continent, some member states are also already thinking to take a number of measures. That has to stop until the withdrawal, and that counts for both sides. Union law is union law and has to be applied fully. Okay. And what is not possible is this type of practices, and that creates, what it creates is anxiety, fear, certainly not trust. If such practices happening, then you say, what will that system be? Yeah, it will be a smooth system. We see it, what smooth it is. Okay. Receiving a letter to go out of the country, that goes smooth, but that is not what we are looking for.
Okay. When she went to Florence, she made an offer which was interpreted as paying 20 billion euros. That's a big figure. Is that enough to persuade you? You could get 5 university chancellors from the UK with that kind of money.
The point there is simple. So she said 2 things were important. That is that all the commitments made by the UK as member state should be honoured. And secondly, that no other member state should receive less or pay more because of Brexit. That were the 2 phrases. But we try now to translate that in reality. And the problem is that until now, the recognition that there has to be need to pay something is limited to payments in 2019 and 2020. Well, everybody knows naturally that if you have made a commitment in 2019 or have made a commitment in 2018 or 2020, that can create and produce payments that are going above 2020. That's one of the first lessons I learned when I became Minister of Budget. The difference between a commitment and a payment. Commitment creates, you do it in 1 year, but the payments or the consequence of that commitment will go over that year of the commitment. Not always, but mostly. And it's depending on what type of expenditure it is. So there we are. So that it's not solved at all.
Okay, let's open it up to questions. We're going to take three or four. Could we take the gentleman in the grey T-shirt here, almost at the back? Could you just say who you are and then the question, please?
My name's Craig Nicholson. I'm a reporter with Research Europe. How do you think that the next EU multi-year budget should deal with the implications of the loss of the UK's contribution? Which programmes, if any, do you think should be cut? And if I could have a second question, isn't there a contradiction in your views when you say that 48% is too big a minority to ignore? But doesn't your own plan for kind of a deeper EU ignore the even bigger minority in Austria who voted for the anti-European president? Wouldn't a more flexible EU be more democratic and better able to deal with the ebb and flow of nationalism?
Okay, thanks. Let's take some questions here. Could we take Tony Giddens in the centre, please?
Well, good evening. Very good to see you here this evening at the LSE. Can you say a bit more about what you think the likely future of the euro is in the eurozone, and specifically whether you think Germany could be persuaded to accept an element of mutualization of debt, since at least a certain amount for the future of the euro, future development of the euro, will plainly depend on this, and will also depend obviously upon a kind of renewed Franco-German cooperation, which has to at least be in the lead in trying to renew and extend the sort of temporary period of flourishing which the euro has at the moment.
Okay, good, thank you. And could we take the gentleman behind?
Charles Grant from the Centre for European Reform. Mr. Verhofstadt, we've had two very different reactions to Brexit in recent speeches. We've had the vision of Juncker and the vision of Macron. Juncker seems to be saying, let's make use of the fact that the British are no longer a Brit by moving forward together. Everybody should join the Euro, the Banking Union, Schengen and so on. Uniformity. While Macron is saying the lesson of Brexit is not everybody wants to do everything. We need more flexibility in our structures. Some countries will move ahead, others won't move ahead. Different tiers of membership. He's even suggested that in the long run, Britain could join an outer rim of the EU. Which of these two visions do you think is better?
Okay, thanks. Do you want to take those? First.
That's a lot, eh? So first of all, what will be the future multi-annual financial framework and in relationship to Brexit? I don't know. What I know is that it depends a lot on what the transition period will be. Will there be a transition period? There is now a request from the UK side to ask for it. And how many years will that be? And that will have naturally also an influence on the MFF, because if you stay in the single market and you stay in the customs union and you stay in a number of policies in this transition period, in our point of view, a transition period can only be the continuation of the existing policies of today and not to reinvent new policies, that is impossible, that will also influence that multi-annual financial framework of the future. On the second question, I come back at the end because I think that's an important point. What is the opinion of people about the European Union? Is that fully translated in the electoral results as we have today? So that's an important issue. But I come to the Eurozone. I think on Eurozone, what we need is we need a management, a government of this Eurozone with a fiscal capacity. That is, in my opinion, the most important. A fiscal capacity, and on a fiscal capacity, normally you can also develop loans and produce loans. So I think that what is not realistic is to think that we can mutualize the debt of the past. And also, Macron has already said, I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for a fiscal capacity who is important, several percentages of the Eurozone, the GDP of the Eurozone, and based on that, you can then develop this fiscal capacity, loans, investment, and so on. That is what he's looking for. And that can be done under in a type of euro securities in the future. And I think that's the way forward. The second thing what we need is what every normal currency authority has, that is a treasury, a minister of finance who is dealing with it. And the third is the most sensitive one, that is how to be sure that that there is not again a division in the Eurozone between the economic policies and the results of these economic policies, what we have seen the last 10 years with a number of countries. The proposal, in my opinion, the best proposal is what we call the convergence goal. That is that it is not necessary that all member states do exactly the same. The problems are different. The pension system, for example, in the Netherlands is a completely different pension system as a pension system in a number of other countries. So it's not the European Union who have to tell what type of reform of that pension system needs to be. But what is the task of the European Union is to define what are on the social and what on the level of finance are the minimum requirements that are needed. So that the system is social sustainable and that the system is financial sustainable. That is the task of the Union. How you do it with a repartition system, a capitalization system, a mixed system, and so on, that is the authority of the nation states. We're gonna not, but the framework as such. So look, I compare it a little bit as a motorway. Convergence code is a motorway. You can take the left of the motorway or the right of the motorway, maybe more that policy of that, but you cannot go out of the motorway. And there has to be a room of maneuver for the countries to do so, but going into the same direction. And then with this fiscal capacity and with this treasury, that makes sense. Because, let's be honest, I have never seen a single currency without any real authority behind state. There exist many states who have no own currency, and we're using the currency of another country, but there don't exist a currency without the state authority behind. And that is also the reason that is... So I think that was a fundamental mistake we have made in the past. It's to think that with the Stability and Growth Pact and with a number of rules, that's sufficient to deal with the problem. That's not true. Certainly not in Europe, when then everybody has an interest maybe not to apply the rules. I look to the other side of the Atlantic and I see that in the end of the 18th century, before the dollar was introduced, they did a federal state. They had treasury certificates that were introduced. And that was the big battle of Hamilton, who won the battle. And then Jefferson received then as compensation Washington as capital. Some people are saying maybe it's also a solution here in Europe. Maybe in Berlin you do then the capital. And then... No, okay, that's a joke. I'm from Belgium, so certainly a joke. what they mean, they did first of all this, and then in the beginning of the 19th century, I don't know what, 1804, they introduced the dollar. We are far more intelligent. We start, and the rest gonna come spontaneously, and then after a certain time you say, oh shit, we don't have this and that and that and that. But no, it's typical for Europe. And we have to stop that mentality. We launch a policy, Schengen. And then we say, oh, there's a migration flow. And then, hey, we don't have a border management at the outside. Why, you normally, if you start to abolish free movement inside a territory, you start to organize your outside border management. No, that seems to me, in my opinion, the logic. And that has to change. There is far too, the idea is, up, we go forward with an idea, oh, the rest will follow. You know, there is not enough support for it now, but it gonna come later on. It doesn't work like that. And it cannot longer work like that when we make reforms in the Union. Juncker, Macron, I don't see personally big difference between both. only on the question, everybody on board, and Macron said, yeah, maybe we have a first group and then a second group that are more associated members. May I say it like that? Associated members. And that's an idea that is already in the air for a long time. My preference is that everybody comes in the core group that I like the most. Because I think there is a fundamental problem, I have indicated it, that is that you cannot continue with the European Union where you have so many opt-ins, opt-outs, earmarks, exceptions, rebates, that you cannot longer explain how the system is working.
Okay.
And but last point...
The guy up here was saying that system may be more flexible and meet public opinion.
Well, look to public opinion. Public opinion, where we do the Eurobarometer on every policy that we are under the form of a question launched to public opinion in Eurobarometer, you have between 70% and 80% of the citizens in Europe who ask for more European action. The reason why they vote for nationalist and populist is not, oh, I don't like Europe. It's because if it doesn't work, if Europe doesn't deliver, it's so easy then for politicians to say, see, it doesn't work, let's fall back to nationalist solutions. While everybody knows that every challenge that we have today, if it's climate change, is migration flows, is it fight against terrorism, is transnational and can only be, in fact, solved on the transnational level.
Okay, let's go to some more questions. There's a lady here, please. Okay, we're happy to have a question.
I've been a public health practitioner most of my life, so I've used EU legislation on environmental and social protection. I doubt that you will win people's hearts by proposing a programme of institutional reform. I think you will win people's hearts by demonstrating protection for citizens. So, is the European Parliament ready to offer those guarantees to British citizens in Europe, regardless of what Theresa May is prepared to do for Europeans here, as an example? And also,
okay,
can we think about, you talked to split allegiances and multiple identities and asylum policy. One of the ways that Europe has lost support is by the sadistic treatment of migrants in detention in Turkey, in Libya, and I know very well that this country has its own detention gulag. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can we take the gentleman right at the very back, please?
Guy Falconbridge, Reuters. It's probably a stupid question, but I just wonder if you could give us your gut instinct. Will Britain and the European Union be able to reach a deal over Brexit?
Okay, okay.
It's good that you announced it as a stupid question.
We're running out of time.
I liberate myself for an answer, so yeah. Okay.
We're running out of time, so if you could answer those two questions.
No, I have already reacted on the second one. On the first one, the issue on standards, social, environmental, and so on. In our resolution, we have said that it concerns also the standards, and that these standards need to be continued to be applied for those who want to enter goods, to do activities in the European Union. We are going to not use the whole Brexit negotiation to undermine the environmental and social standards we have. I should say that on the contrary. But then I want to react to something that you say. Yeah, you're going to not... I hear that from time to time with institutional proposals to convince the people and so on and so on. And that's true. But it is crucial that I'm talking about that, because political institutions are the basis for a lot of things. Bad political institutions produce bad results. Good political institutions produce good results. We need to know that. It is not like, oh yeah, political institutions, that's something for politicians and we don't like that. No, it does matter. One of the books that I like the most, and that has been written the last years, is a book, Why Nations Fail, of Acemoglu and Robinson. And in Why Nations Fail, Yeah, the basic idea in that book is that it's not the economic stupids, it's politics stupids. That's the main. And for a politician, that's a fantastic book, naturally, that we matter. So, and what it mainly say that if you don't have the right institutions, not the property rights, not the rule of law, not this. And it starts with a fantastic story, Nogales, that is a city on the border between Mexico and the U.S. And it's really on the border. So the north of the city lies in the U.S. and the south is in Mexico. And there are living the same people. They are family from each other. They ate the same hot Mexican food. So no difference. They have the same DNA. But in the north, they are 5 times richer than in the south. And why? Because in the north, there is certainty, property rights, rule of law, democracy. And in the south of the city, there is corruption, corruption, corruption. And that makes the difference. So political institutions matters. It's not true that it is a little game of constitutionalists, of politicians who have nothing else to do than to think about. No. Good institutions produce good results. Bad institutions, bad results. And that is the problem in the Union for the moment. Not that our founding fathers has made mistakes. They didn't make a mistake because in the 50s they had everything in place. It's fantastic. The reason why I wrote the last book about Europe's last chance was, for me, bad student at the university certainly, the discovery of the von Brentano constitution of the 50s on the European Union. I thought, yeah, the European Union started with the Treaty of Rome in 1957 and so on and so on. No, not true. The European Union started before with the idea, after the success of the European State and Co-Community, on which I have to tell you and remind you that Winston Churchill wanted to participate, but he lost the vote in the Commons with a few votes. It started at that moment, and there was the agreement between the 6 founding fathers and the representatives of the 6 founding fathers with unanimity and 5 abstentions, not bad in politics, unanimity and 5 abstentions, to start with the Constitution and with that communitarian proposal that I'm talking about, European Defense Community, a European government with maximum 15. So what Macron says, that's the number, 15, comes out of this first constitution of the 50s. Of von Brentano. Von Brentano was a little bit the competitor of Adenauer. And Adenauer said, you do European politics, I will do German politics. And so a little bit like that. And he was also one of the founding fathers of the Grundgesetz in Germany. So there is an enormous resemblance about. But everything was in. It's fantastic. I was reading it and I said, what we have done in 50 years? why we don't have it? And the real story of the European Union is it didn't start with a success, it started with a failure. The failure to go through with this constitution and the European Defense Community in the French National Assembly in 1954 were against the will of these 70 people, representatives of the 6 states, that defense union was not accepted. Also a little bit because at that moment there was a new prime minister, Pierre Mendès-France, and it was a project of his predecessor, and he didn't launch a confidence vote in the National Assembly. What normally you do as prime minister from time, you have a project, you say, now confidence vote. Also happening in Britain, I think, from time to time. And that failed, or he didn't really engage in this. So we have nothing to invent of that. There was already European Parliament foreseen in 1954. We have it only since 1979. And it became then the Treaty of Rome with the internal, with the customs union mainly, because we failed to do the big leap forward. But I think we have no choice. We have to go back to the initial idea of the founding fathers, because it was not like a dream that they have put that on paper and put that in a project of constitution. It was because of necessity that they did it, because the lesson they learned. And they said this is the only way to go forward in the future. But maybe it's now the moment to do so. What was impossible in the 50s can maybe possible
now.
Okay, thank you. I'm afraid we are out of time, but just before, I'm sorry?
My question.
You found it stupid, your question?
Oh, sorry, yes. Briefly, please. Just briefly.
Sorry?
You won't find it difficult to answer.
So. No. Can you repeat your question? Because, really, maybe I didn't.
Do you think that the European Union and Britain will find agreement on Brexit so they will be able to do a deal?
That's the assumption that I have. And it's in that, towards that we work. And that the withdrawal agreement will be done in... March 2019 means that there has to be an agreement, in fact, in October, November, because then this agreement will go to the European Parliament, and we need 4 or 5 months to go to the consent procedure.
Okay, I think that presentation has been so good, we should recognise it with the huge generosity of the LSE by offering you a gift. Now, I come from Yorkshire, and generosity has to be tempered in that context. So there's generosity and there's Yorkshire generosity. So please do appreciate the gift I'm about to give you, which is an LSE baseball cap.